Hi again, everybody. It's nice to be here. I'm getting used to coming to Seattle and being with Sims. I recognize a lot of faces. How's the sound? Still okay? And the one guy who said he couldn't hear, is it better now? Better? Okay. It was nice at Bastyr, remember? Bastyr? It's nice here too, though. This is more contemporary, right? More downtown. I want to start my talk about imagination with a poem by George Oppen. And this poem is called The Tongues, and the title is also the first line of the poem. The tongues of appearance speak in the unchosen journey immense. Journey there is loss and denying that forces the moments, the years, even of death lost in denying that force, the words out of that whirlwind, his and not his, strange words surround him. The tongues of appearance speak in the unchosen journey, immense journey, there is loss in denying that force the moments, the years, even of death lost in denying that force, the words out of that whirlwind, his and not his, strange words surround him. Kind of a mysterious, wonderful poem. And so I've been thinking about the imagination. And a few years ago, because I think that spiritual practice is inherently a practice of the imagination. It's inherently an imaginative undertaking, as is all art making, music, all of it. It evokes the imagination, and we need it. We need that for our lives. So I got interested in studying the history of the idea of the imagination in our culture, starting with the Greeks. And it was a really interesting thing to study. And I wrote a long essay about it, which I will spare you, but let's start with Coleridge anyway. I'd like to start there with Samuel Taylor Coleridge, who had a very famous take on the imagination. Coleridge was one of the Romantic poets in 19th century England, and he went to the continent to study the new idealist philosophy that was current on the continent. He could speak German, and he could read and study those philosophies. And he was one of the first people to bring the philosophies of Hegel and other idealists to the English-speaking world. So that might help to know that, to appreciate what he has to say here about the imagination. It's very famous. If you study literature, you will always, your anthology will always quote this saying of Coleridge's about the imagination. The imagination, then, I consider either as primary or secondary. The primary imagination I hold to be the living power and prime agent of all human perception. And as a repetition in the finite mind of the eternal act of creation in the infinite I am. Well, that's a mouthful right there. But it's astonishing what he's saying there. He's saying that imagination is behind all human perception. And it's an imitation or a repetition in our finite minds of the act of creation of the Creator. He's a Christian, we're coming from a Judeo-Christian perspective of the Creator, the beyond human. So we're creating the world in perception by our imaginations, in just the same way the world is created anew by the divine. That's the primary imagination. The secondary imagination I consider as an echo of the former, coexisting with the conscious will, yet still as identical with the primary in kind of its agency, and differing only in degree and in the mode of operation. It dissolves, diffuses, dissipates in order to recreate, or where this process is rendered impossible, yet still at all events it struggles to idealize and unify. It is essentially vital, even as all objects, as objects, are essentially fixed and dead. So what he's talking about there is artistic creation, which he calls a secondary imagination. So the primary imagination, he says, is basically that we're alive and that a world exists for us. That's an act of the imagination, he thinks. And it's an echo in us of divinity. So that's something, right? Being alive is necessarily an act of the imagination. And the more you know that, and the more you give yourself to that, the more alive you can be, the more alive your world can be. And then, based on that primary imagination, there can be the creation of works of art that are, as he says, an effort to recreate that primary experience, to idealize and unify a world. So, now a little bit of explanation as I wrote this here. So, for Coleridge, imagination is perception. We don't see, hear, or taste the world. We imagine it. We imagine it. Just as God created the world through an act of divine imagination, conjuring it up with a spell of words, what we usually think of as imagination, human creativity, Coleridge calls the secondary imagination. It grapples with the real through a process of deconstruction in perception. As he says, it dissolves, diffuses, dissipates, taking the world's apparent fixity apart in order to bring it back to life in a more energized and fruitful way. Without this process, the world would not be real for us. It would just lay there, dead meat, a source of dread and the horror of a relentlessly unresponsive world in which we are lost. And I think when a person falls into like deep depression or despair, that's what the world looks like. A deeply unresponsive world just laying there with no relationship to the imagination. That happens to us, and that's awful. This process of making the world real is difficult. The world resists. So struggle, which he uses the word struggle, so struggle is necessary in order to idealize and unify experience so that we don't go mad with purposeless confusion in a fixed and dead universe. Objects as objects, he says, are fixed and dead. I think the world would drive us mad, you know, if we didn't exercise our imaginations to live in it. You can't get out of bed in the morning. It takes without an act of imagination. Really. You go forth into your day based on some imagination and faith. So, for Coleridge, imagination is essentially the religious function. If by religion one means reality seeking, which is what I mean by it. Now, Coleridge distinguishes poetries, because he's talking here about poetry, but I'm talking about poetry, but also our practice, our spiritual practice. Coleridge distinguishes poetry's reality seeking from that of science or philosophy. These disciplines seek truth per se. Poetry seeks pleasure, joy. Not sensual pleasure, not intellectual or aesthetic pleasure either. And here's what he says about the pleasure that is sought in poetry as opposed to science or philosophy. A poem is that species of composition which is opposed to works of science by proposing for its immediate object pleasure and not truth. And from all other species, having this object in common with it, it is discriminated by proposing to itself such delight from the whole as is compatible with a distinct gratification from each component part. So then he's saying that poetry, what's pleasurable and wonderful and joyful about poetry, and I would argue the same is true of our spiritual practice, is that we have a feeling of wholeness. We have a feeling that every part of reality contains the whole, that there's a meaningfulness to our perception and our being in the world. So then, my words here. Truth is sober, serious, and linear. Poetry is fluid, vital, elusive, delightful, not necessarily factual or accurate in its statements or descriptions. Its pleasure comes from its communicating the feeling of wholeness that we crave but seldom experience, and communicating it through appreciation of parts. So that, say, the description of sky in a Wordsworth poem is more than sky. It evokes rather the whole and the feeling of wholeness, which is what makes it poetry. Such acts of pleasurable imagination are exactly religious in that they give us, in our sphere, exactly the sense that God would have in his or hers, a sense of creation, a world made new, the same exaltation and tragic satisfaction. So it's interesting to think, I think we, especially in our moment when our practice is pretty thoroughly psychologized and even now like studied in laboratories and things, it would be very easy to think of it as a self-cultivation mechanism for calming the mind or creating certain qualities and so on, which it is. But let's not forget this other dimension, which is really the religious dimension, that there's a feeling of wholeness and of creativity and of belonging and of waking up a world. That is, I think, an essential component of all spiritual practice. So I'll skip a part of the essay, and now this part of the essay, this is a little bit technical, but I'll try to, you know, kind of elide some of it so it's not too boring. But this is now something about Buddhist philosophy. The Lankavatara Sutra is a key Buddhist philosophical text, generative particularly for the Zen school. It's not a text that would be read in Theravada Buddhism. Because, you know, the Mahayana Buddhism is like wildly imaginative. You're aware of that, right? If you read Mahayana Buddhist texts, it's like outrageously poetic. Worlds upon worlds upon worlds and endless bodhisattvas doing, amazing, outrageous, impossible things. So the Lankavatara Sutra is a philosophical text in that tradition. So it has a it's based on a system of understanding mind of eight consciousnesses. That's the schema of the Lankavatara Sutra and of other sutras, Buddhist sutras, that are in the mind-only school of Buddhist thought. So the first five consciousnesses are the five sense organs and their objects, and the consciousness that arises when an eye meets an object that can be seen and an ear meets an object that can be heard. A consciousness, eye consciousness arises, ear consciousness arises, and so the five senses are the first five consciousnesses. And the clear implication of distinguishing each of these from the other as distinct, and cognitive science, by the way, does bear this out, that each there's a different part of the brain and a different consciousness that's associated with each sensual or sense organ. What this is saying is that the world, what we call the world, that seems to be a coherent thing, is not actually an organized whole, but is rather a cacophony of warring mental impressions that come in five different clusters according to the five senses, each one completely different from the other. And it would seem that it would take an extreme meditator, as many Buddhists were and are, to figure this out. Someone so attuned to the subtleties of subjectivity and the process of perception itself that they could appreciate how absolutely different seeing something is from hearing something. Did you ever think of that? It's like sometimes I think, how could seeing and hearing exist in the same universe? They're so different from each other. They seem like different planets, you know, and all the senses are like that. Smelling something, it's a totally different experience, right, from seeing or hearing. And how astonishing is it that out of this total confusion and utter difference, we manage to create what appears to be, at least on the surface, a reasonable world. How do we do it? By imagination. So the sixth consciousness is mental consciousness. And in this scheme, it's the sixth consciousness because the mind is an organ, just like the ear or the eye. And the mind is the organ that creates a unified impression from the data produced by the first five consciousnesses. And this consciousness is also intimately involved with the process of language and thought. You literally hear or see or smell what you can conceptualize and define, and not what you cannot conceptualize or define. You can't see or hear that thing if you have no idea what it is. So even if you don't know a name for it, you have a conception of it. Otherwise, there's no hearing. So the conceptual faculty and the sense organs always operate together. Consciousness seven is the sense of I, of coherent subjectivity. And it seems to have been conceived, this idea of the seventh consciousness, in counter-distinction to the famous early Buddhist teaching of no self, non-self, anatta, which I think was probably as counterintuitive and baffling to people in ancient Asia as it is to us today. What? No self? How could that be? I know I'm here, you know. I mean, Buddha says there's no self, but I can't help it. I keep, you know, waking up every morning and I'm still me, you know, what can I say? So to account for this, the mind-only philosophers conceived of the idea of a seventh consciousness, like the other six, that was for the purpose of creating a sense of coherent self. In fact, as any psychologist will tell you, personal subjectivity seems necessary for there to be any coherent perception or any coherent activity. If you lose your, I guess they call it now, the executive function, you're sunk. The consciousness eight, they call the storehouse consciousness. It is analogous to the Western psychological concept of the unconscious, a large, primordial, and mostly unknown substrate of consciousness that seems to surface in dreams or other weird, sort of off-the-books kinds of experiences. And often, although mostly it's unknown, as we know, it drives behavior sometimes in ways only dimly understood. Storehouse consciousness, as in some Western conceptions of the unconscious, is not limited to the personal. It's a universal consciousness, and it includes all the seeds of cumulative past events, not only ones in one's personal life, but in other lives, whose shadows remain in the storehouse until deeds and thoughts of the present moment water those seeds, and then they sprout and they come to fruition in thought, word, or deed. Now, people often say about Buddhism that it's not a philosophical system, and it isn't even a psychology. It's a soteriological practice. In other words, the point of Buddhist practice is not to give an accurate map of how the mind works or anything like that. The whole point of it is suffering and end of suffering. So if it gives a map of the mind or something like that, it's not saying this is the truth. In fact, the eight consciousness teaching says this is not real. The only purpose of setting forth something like that is because it might help to reduce suffering or end suffering. So this applies also to this mind-only system. The eight consciousnesses are the realm of human suffering. They're produced by the endless destructive confusion of human experience, and they are the ongoing transformation or evolution of consciousness without beginning, end, or escape. Very bad news. But wait, there is an alternative to that horrible news. According to the Lankavatara Sutra, there can be what they call personal realization of Buddhahood. And this realization is the salvific kernel at the heart of consciousness. So at the very heart of consciousness, there is a point of salvation that can be set in motion by bringing consciousness back to the beginning and reversing it, turning it, and thereby untying at the root its endless knot. And this revolution of consciousness reverses the energy of the ongoing wheel of circular suffering, transforming it into a lasting happiness suffused with love and the desire to serve. So as you know, in Theravada Buddhism, the stated goal in the scriptures is to end rebirths so that, you know, a Buddha ultimately gets to the place where that Buddha does not have to return again and again and again to this round of endless suffering. But in this system, the goal is to flip the whole thing around so that you are reborn again and again and again, except instead of being reborn out of the restless energy of suffering, you're reborn now out of love for the purpose of sharing life with others for mutual benefit. So the same energy is just flipped around. And when you think about it, as we know, you know, how easily have you seen in your life how on a dime love turns into hate, right? Well, this is saying turn hate into love, just that quickly. So they talk about all this and this possibility of transforming the mind. There's a teaching called the three realities. Reality number one, the sutra calls imaginary reality. What is imaginary reality according to this sutra, according to this teaching? Imaginary reality is the ordinary world that we live in, which is understood to be a dreamlike projection of the mind. And because we don't know that, we make that world into a realm of suffering that feels all too real to us. The second reality is called dependent reality, which is the fluid network of connection, interdependence, which is what the world actually is. And the third reality is called perfected reality, which is none other than the first reality seen for the projection that it really is, and thus redeemed. In Zen, this same idea is given a much more poetic description in that famous Zen line which is saying exactly the same thing that you've probably heard about. Before I started my practice, mountains were mountains and rivers were rivers. And when I began to practice and really fully engage in practice, I saw that mountains are not mountains and rivers are not rivers. But now that I practiced a really, really long time, mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. You come back to the beginning, the ordinary everyday world, but with a brand new feeling and a brand new possibility. Now, in the Lankavatara language, the word imagination is used in the opposite way from the way Coleridge uses it and the way I'm using it. Reality, as we know it, is a fantasy. It's unreal. What could be more unreal than the mad rush for power and purchase, the endless distraction and destruction, the wars, the sexism, racism, fascism, the addictions, the unhappiness, the mania for entertainment, the debased sense of personhood, the anxiety, the confusion, the despair, the mass murder, the suicide, the economic dread, the political madness. This is the definition of a fantasy, a nightmare fantasy, all a product of a fantasy that we don't know is a fantasy. And I say here parenthetically that saying this doesn't refute economic and political causes of social misery. It doesn't say that they're irrelevant. It just says that underneath those economic and political causes, there are psycho-spiritual causes that are primary. In other words, you still have to address those problems, but address them understanding their source and their root. The revolution or transformation that the Lankavatara's teaching is pointing to is, it seems to me, exactly what Coleridge is talking about when he talks about the transformative power of the poetic. And this is a power that we need, really need, in our lives. Each one of us personally needs it, and I think we need it as a world, as a society. A transformation that makes us more humane and happier. If, as I believe, that the world we're living in now, which is so troubling, is a failure of the imagination, then poetry and all works of the imagination, including religion, are a healing of it. I was listening to the radio the other day, and a woman came on who's poet laureate of youth literature. So like, you know, there's like YA literature, young adult literature. I didn't know this, but young adult literature has its own like poet laureate. So she's an adult, you know, writing books for young adults. Anyway, she was talking about her upbringing, which was difficult. And she was brought up, I think, a Seventh-day Adventist, and a religion that she didn't follow through with. But the interviewer asked her, well, what was it like for you going to church? And she said, it was so wonderful. Because the life that I was living, surrounded by all these adults who were suffering and in trouble, was so tough. But when I went to church and I heard these Bible stories, it was like a world of the imagination. I could live in that world. I could be saved by that world. And it got me through. And I think that's right. You know, I think as children, we go to our churches or mosques or Buddhist temples or whatever we go to, and we sense a world of the imagination, a world that we can truly live in. Unfortunately, we get older and we get disappointed in that world, possibly because we don't know how to mature in it. But I think that's true. I think that all throughout our human history, there's no record of any human settlement of any kind, of any size, that didn't have some kind of religious dimension to it. I hope you're okay? Yeah? Maybe not feeling well. Yeah, she's okay. This means we need this, right? We always produce some imaginative realm that makes this material world that we live in livable. Because actually, it's not livable just alone. We need something else. So now I'm going to tell you one of the most astonishing stories of the imagination that I've ever heard. And maybe you've heard this story, but I hadn't heard it. I heard it recently and I never heard it before. And this is as written by Susan Griffin, the author Susan Griffin. Even in the grimmest of circumstances, a shift in perspective can create startling change. I'm thinking of a story I heard a few years ago from my friend Odette, a writer and survivor of the Holocaust. Here's Odette's story. Along with many others who crowd the bed of a large truck, she tells me, is the surrealist poet Robert Desnos. Robert Desnos was one of the original surrealists, and more than any of the others, he had absolute faith in the power of the imagination. He was so committed to giving the imagination free rein in his poetry, and he just thought that this was the most important thing in the world, and he had complete faith in it. So Desnos was Jewish. During the war, he joined the French underground and was captured, and as a Jewish person was taken to the camps. So in this story, he's on the bed of a large truck being taken away with others, being taken away from the barracks of the concentration camp where he has been held prisoner. Leaving the barracks, the mood is somber. Everyone knows the truck is headed for the gas chambers. And when the truck arrives, no one can speak at all. Even the guards fall silent. But this silence is soon interrupted by an energetic man who jumps into the line and grabs one of the condemned people's hands. Improbable as it might seem, Odette told me, Desnos, because that's who it was, reads the man's palm. He's apparently a palm reader. "Oh," he says, "I see you have a very, very long lifeline. And you are going to have 3 children. And he gets so excited by this palm reading. And his excitement and his joy is contagious. And first one man, then another offers up his hand. And Desnos grabs one hand after the other and he reads the palm. And each time his prediction is for longevity, more children, and abundant joy. As Desnos reads more palms, not only does the mood of the prisoners change, but that of the guards too. How can one explain it? Perhaps the element of surprise has planted a shadow of doubt in their minds. If they told themselves that these deaths were inevitable, that no longer seems inarguable. They are in any case so disoriented by this sudden change of mood among those they are about to kill that they are unable to go through with the executions. So all the men, along with Desnos, are packed back onto the truck and taken back to the barracks. Desnos has saved his own life and the lives of others by using his imagination. Can you believe that? That's amazing. And they went back to the barracks. Soon after that, the war ended and they were not executed. Desnos was not executed in the camps. He actually died not long after that from illness, but he was not executed in the camps. So, I was so amazed by this story that I actually got a hold of Susan Griffin, who I don't know, and I said, "Susan, is this a true story? Is this really true?" And she said, "Well, Odette, who was her friend who was in the camps, said it was true and that she had heard it. She was not present, but she said that she had heard it from a friend of hers who was in the camps and was there." So, I suppose, on the one hand, we could say we don't really know if it's true, you know. But then I thought about it more, and I thought to myself, I know it's true. It's really true. When you think about it, you know, we're all, being a human being among other human beings in a society is like being under a magic spell, you know? It really is. And I think the only explanation that you could really give for how could something like the Shoah happen? How could so many people, I mean, there might have been some like really evil people who wanted to do this, but how you account for the many, many thousands of people who were either participated or were complicit in one way? There's no accounting for it. It makes no sense. The only way it makes sense is to think that everybody was under some kind of a spell, that this was what was happening, this is the way it was, there was nothing that could be done, this was, you know, and we're all like that, we're all living in that world. We all live in, not that world, but some world in which we all agree there's a kind of a shared sense of reality that isn't necessarily real, but everybody believes it, and it's impossible to believe anything else when you're under that spell. Well, when Desnos, through the imagination, breaks through that spell, I think that these guards realize, oh, wait a minute, we, What's wrong with us? What are we doing? This can't be. We're sending people off to thee. This can't be. This is impossible. They kind of woke up out of a dream. The imagination pierced through their dream. And this is exactly what we're talking about with spiritual practice, right? Let's pierce through the dream that we're all living. And let's see the actual life that we're living. I think the actual life that we're living is very expansive and loving. If you sit there on your cushion and you just sit there with your life, life coming and going every minute. First of all, like, what is it? You don't even know. Where did it come from? You don't even, nobody knows what life is exactly, you know? It's some kind of a miracle. Nobody knows what it is. How did it get here? Where does it go when it goes? It makes no sense. If you ever attend someone who's dying and dies right in front of you, you think to yourself, what? What? You don't know what happened. You can't, it doesn't make any sense. It really doesn't. So what is going on here is not at all explained by our explanations. And you feel that. I feel that when I'm sitting sometimes, you know. I sit and my mind settles a little bit and I return to just that I'm alive here and I stop thinking about myself and all my little stupid problems, you know. And I'm just sitting here, alive, in the middle of this miracle, which could not exist without everyone else, right? There's no life without many lives. There's no such thing. You could maybe imagine and think up the idea of a human being existing without any other creatures existing. But that could never be. That's not possible. If there's a human being, it means there's a world of human beings. It means there's a planet Earth. It means there's a sky and an ocean and trees and plants. You feel that all when you feel your own life. This is your actual life. And mostly, we don't even know that, right? Why? Because we're too busy making the rent and all that. So I think we really do. I think really the world that we're living in and all of its problems, which seems so immense, really it comes down to a failure of the imagination. And I think that you could really honestly and practically speaking view spiritual practice as a healing of the imagination, and all the arts too. I think, in the beginning, there was no distinction between the arts and spirituality. Our world has been one in which we've made more and more distinctions and created separate fiefdoms for all these different things. But there was no music in the beginning that wasn't sacred music, that wasn't, you know, an expression of the feeling for the divine, for spirituality. There was no art that wasn't an expression of the same thing. So we need the arts, we need the imagination, we need creativity, we need spiritual practice, and we need to see that all those things, and it's possible that spiritual practice may be the most basic among them, just to sit, right, in silence, in presence. So spiritual practice is the supreme act of the imagination. So this makes me want to read you some Desnos poems. Doesn't it make you curious about Desnos poems? So I'll read you a couple and then we'll talk. Under cover of night. To slip into your shadow, under cover of night. To follow your footsteps, your shadow at the window. That shadow at the window is you and no one else. It's you. Do not open that window. behind whose curtains you're moving. Shut your eyes. I'd like to shut them with my lips. But the window opens and the breeze which strangely balances flag and flame, surrounds my escape with its cloak. The window opens. It's not you. I knew it all along. This one is called Ebony Life. A frightening stillness will mark that day. In the shadow of street lights and fire alarms will exhaust the light. All things, the quietest and the loudest, will be silent. The suckling brats will die. The tugboats, the locomotives, the wind will glide by in silence. We will hear the great voice which, coming from far away, will pass over the city. We will wait a long time for it. Then, at the rich man's time of day, when the dust, the stones, the missing tears form the sun's robe on the huge deserted squares, we shall finally hear the voice. It will growl at doors for a long while. It will pass over the town, tearing up flags and breaking window panes. We will hear it. What silence before it, but still greater the silence it will not disturb, but will hold guilty, will brand and denounce days of sorrows and joys. The day to come when the voice will pass over the city. A ghostly seagull told me she loved me as much as I loved her, that this great, terrible silence was my love, that the wind carrying the voice was the great revolt of the world, and that the voice would look kindly on me. So, thank you for listening. Let's just take a few minutes to have a conversation with another person sitting nearby. Maybe about just a 5 or 6 minute conversation, pretty short. Just talk to each other about the place of the imagination in your life. Is it something that you're engaged in? Is what I'm saying to you tonight seem like outrageous and you never heard of it? Or is it, how does the imagination work in your life? Is it part of your life, and how? So just, I'll look at the clock and we'll stop in about 20 of or something like that. So just find somebody nearby and just introduce yourselves and just talk. That was nice. It's cheery to talk about the imagination, isn't it? There are a lot of smiles around the room. It's a lot more fun than talking about suffering and and the problem of the world and so on and so on. So let's talk for, we have maybe 10 or 15 minutes. What do you want to bring up or share from what you were saying or hearing? Yeah.
Why do you focus on
That's good. Yeah, art integrating into science is good. Yeah, I guess I'm focusing on the imagination, and science can seem like the opposite of that, right? It can seem very science. I mean, is really basically dealing with the material world, right? It's concerned with the world of matter and how it works and what can be done with it and investigating it and so on. Whereas the imagination is concerned with sort of the space between things. So, not that it doesn't take a lot of imagination to do science, and not that science can also contribute to this discussion of the imagination, and as you're suggesting, not that science can't be suffused with the imagination too, but the way at this moment it seems that science is existing in our world, it doesn't need more support. You know what I mean? It really is. Science has been, I mean, in our world at this moment, science has been marshaled, the knowledge of science and the scientific work has been largely marshaled by business and finance. Most of the things that science do are applicable, we can make money from them, which is why we validate science. The imagination, we don't seem to be able to figure out a way to monetize it very well, unless you think about Pixar, things like that. But I guess what I'm talking about is something other than that. But some of my best friends are scientists. Do you want to say more?
I agree that the current mode of science, quote unquote, is certainly in the hands of the powers that be. But I think of it in terms of daily life. And I ran the cycling company for 5 years, and every day was an act of art and imagination to create a business that didn't exist before.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yes, yes. Right. Yeah. I see what you're saying. Yeah. No. Well. Right. The imagination. That's why I like that quote from Coleridge, because he's saying that the primary imagination is, like you're saying, living every day, creatively and full of imagination in your living, in the material world. Right. It's not just making art. In fact, I think there's something bad about divorcing art from the rest of life, as if it weren't just as much an act of the imagination to have done what you did as it would be to make a painting or something like that. And you know, speaking of art, speaking of monetizing science, you know, I mean, think of the price of a Picasso, you know, or some artist that somebody figures out is an important artist. So everything gets monetized in our world. Right, but I think, to me, it's one of the most important points about spiritual practice is just that yes, cooking dinner is an act of the imagination. Running a business is an act of the imagination. You know, talking to a friend is an act of the imagination when you bring your whole heart to it and you really see it as an avenue for life. Yeah, right. Yeah, that's a fantasy, right?
I was thinking of kind of like a helmet of worries and
right,
concerns
right.
around your head that keep you from seeing the simplicity.
Right, and I think that we don't appreciate the extent to which we create that ourselves. even though there really is an appointment to get to and there really is this obligation and so on, that the aura of being rushed and oppressed by all these things is something that we collude in and create. It doesn't have to be that way. It really doesn't have to be that way. I mean, we have to apply ourselves to make it be different, because the spell that we're living under, let's be honest, is very powerful. It's not trivial. It's very powerful. So it takes a lot of effort and a lot of support to break that spell, but it can be broken. Yeah.
So would you go so far to say that suffering is a lack of imagination?
Yeah, suffering is a failure of the imagination, right? Now, that doesn't mean that if we were fully imaginative, bad things wouldn't happen. But we would see those bad things as another opportunity to engage deeply in this mystery of being alive, even if we were in pain or had suffered some loss. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Right? And then also it supplied the imagination that helped us make sort of manage our material reality. Mm-hmm. And I keep sitting with like both of those because they seem, I don't know, different or something. And I'm curious if you can say a little bit about that.
How I'm not sure how they seem different. They don't seem different to me. Explain to me how they seem. Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But then it's this like endeavor to get closer to action.
Oh, I see. Right, right.
Right,
well, right. If you, the ordinary way of thinking about the imagination is that it's the opposite of reality.
Right.
So there's reality and then there's the imagination, which is a kind of like, it's just not real. It's fun.
Yeah.
And we might enjoy it, but it's not real. But I'm arguing the opposite. I'm saying that actually what we think is real is a fantasy. And that, so that's how come it doesn't seem different to me, right? Because then when we enter the world of the imagination, we're making the world real. We're actually making the world real. So, for instance, if we do meditation practice and have, you know, a powerful understanding of our life through the meditation practice, and then we end the meditation retreat and we go forth into the world and we say, well, now I'm in the real world, oh God, none of that matters anymore because now it's the real world, then we're really missing an opportunity, right? Because actually what we're learning on the meditation cushion is true all the time. We just didn't know it before. The world was too noisy for us to see what was going on. Now that we know what's going on, we should be living that. We shouldn't be going and meditating and then having a nice time. Might as well go to the movies, really, right? Or something that would be entertaining. A lot of things are a lot more entertaining than meditation, really. So the goodness of it would be that we would learn something about what's real through the imaginative act of meditation, and then we would then transform the world we were living in. So that's why it didn't seem this different to me. Yeah. Because I'm using the word imagination in the opposite way that usually people use it. Right.
Can you give me the definition of the way you use imagination? The definition of imagination?
Imagination, I would say, is that human faculty that makes the world real. I mean, I just made that up, but that's what I think. That's what I think, yeah. So you look extremely quizzical when I say that.
Because to me, imagination is making the world not real. For some reason, I have a very conflicting idea of what you think imagination is and what I think imagination is. Because imagination means creating something that is imaginative, that thoughts bring into an imagination that is not real.
Yeah, like a Catholic rabbi. Yeah. You could imagine a Catholic rabbi. You could say that phrase, but you could never find anywhere a Catholic rabbi. Right. I see the problem, well, you know, in the interest of not making my talk too complicated, I left out a part that might be relevant here. The part that I left out was Coleridge, when he talks about the imagination, remember the primary imagination, which is perception and creating a world that we're actually living in, and then secondary imagination, which he says is the poetic and other creative arts. Then he says there's another thing called the fancy, which we would probably call today fantasy. And fantasy is like a Catholic rabbi or something that we would make up that wouldn't be real or wouldn't be true. So there is a faculty of the mind that is just makes up things that are not real and not increasing our sense of reality and living. So what we call in our world the imagination and the imaginative, he would call fancy. So, but when you say the imagination makes the world unreal, then I'm thinking, well, that sounds good. Because the word real is already a problem, right? Already, when we say something is real, it's already oppressive. You know what I mean? Do you get what I'm saying? Like, oh, this is, when we say something is real, what we mean is, it's very heavy and now I have to carry it around. That's what we mean when we say real. So, because there's a whole branch of Buddhist teaching, right, about emptiness, right, which says nothing is real. Everything is unreal. It's not heavy. You don't have to carry it around. It's not real. Including the Buddhist teachings. Buddhism is not real. You don't have to carry it around. That's the Heart Sutra, right? No eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no suffering, no origination, no stopping, no path. So the idea of reality already has its problems built in. But then, as soon as you start talking about this, it becomes inescapable. Now you're talking about talking, right? You're talking about language and words. And that was that poem that I read you in the beginning about words. Terrible words, his and not his, terrible words surround him. Our words, our thoughts, are creating issues and problems built in to the words and the thoughts. And yet, we're language creatures. We can't get out of language as human beings. So how do we liberate ourselves? How do we see the trap of our language and liberate ourselves within our language? That's a very important part of spiritual practice, I think. It also has something to do with poetry, too. Yeah. Well, I think maybe last thing, and then I know we have to have some announcements, and then we're done. Yeah. Yes, yes, I know.
Pretty darned.
Yeah, exactly.
Imagine. Yeah, yeah. Imagine there might be a being who could potentially
Yeah.
And I remember fairly recently I heard an interview with the Dalai Lama, and he said, well, you know, when he was born, supposedly he was reincarnated as an emanation of Avalokitesvara, and he said at first he thought, yeah, you know, sounds good, but after about 50 or 60 years, he's starting to think, you know, he's imagining, perhaps.
Yeah, yeah.
It could be.
Yeah.
And he said it in his charming and humorous and inclusive way, but I was thinking,
Yeah.
After several decades of entertaining that idea or being entertained by it.
Yeah. No, absolutely. The Bodhisattva path is a path of the imagination. Bodhisattvas make extravagantly imaginative vows that are impossible to fulfill and feel that they're living that life and are. Yeah, that's what I want to speak about on the weekend retreat, is the Bodhisattva path as a path of the imagination. Exactly so, yeah. Yeah.